Hey there, sex fans. Welcome back. Today is Monday, March 29th, 2010, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge. And I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick.
Where do you think you are? In some fucking Regency costume drama?
Listen, if you're going to be part of the audience, you're just going to have to sit there and be quiet. Listen, we're back with more of the erotic mind of the marvelous author Rick R. Reed. And we really get down and dirty this week. You know, since the beginning of this podcast series, well over 2 years ago, I've been wanting to discuss the connection between sex and suspense and sexuality and horror. But not until Rick showed up on the scene was this conversation possible. In this, part two of our chat, I discover his uncanny ability to delve into people's psychosexual motivations. No wonder he's the master of his craft.
You're in sexual health, aren't you? That's ironic.
Oh, snap. Part one of my chat with Rick appeared last week at this time. But wait, did you somehow miss last week's installment? Well, that's just not right. But don't worry, you can make it up. All my podcasts are archived on my site, drdicksexadvice.com, and all you have to do is use the site's search function. Type in podcast number 194 and presto! But don't forget the pound sign when you do your search. As a special treat, Rick will share with us two more dark yet fanciful selections from the fruit of his erotic mind. And for all things Rick R. Reed, visit his website, rickrreed.com. And he's on Facebook too, don't you know? Facebook.com/rickrreed. Today's podcast is once again brought to you by the granddaddies of male masturbation toys, the amazing Fleshlight and Fleshjack.
I'm sorry about earlier.
Don't worry. For those of you who have never seen one of these brilliant devices, let me describe it to you. It looks like a huge flashlight, thus the very clever names. Inside the durable plastic case, there's a soft, fleshy inside called Super Skin. And trust me, this stuff is aptly named. It's phenomenal. But that's just the beginning. What makes Fleshlight and Fleshjack so freaking amazing is that you get to design and personalize just about every aspect of the unit you purchase. Now, what other toy company allows you to do that? And ladies, here's a tip. This is the perfect gift for your man. You know how I keep talking about the mutual joys and the important information shared when a couple masturbates together, right? Well, this is the ideal masturbation toy for him. Check it out and see for yourself. I know you will agree. Nothing beats a Fleshlight. Look for their banner in the sidebar of drdicksexadvice.com. You'll be so glad you did.
Do you know what you sounded like? You sounded like a fucking Nazi Julie Andrews.
Alrighty then, let's get on with the show.
Welcome back, Rick R. Reed, and thank you again for joining us this week. I hope you had a pleasant week last.
It just flew by.
Didn't it though? And I know from the reaction we're getting from our audience that they're enjoying your website, and we'll be talking more about that in a bit. But I want to pick up exactly where we left off last week, if you don't mind. And we were talking about the creative process, and I just wanted to say that most of the erotica that I read is exceptionally brief, yet very powerful, because it's short story-ish. And because of that, every word must count. But you write erotic novels as well as short stories, so I assume that the dynamic for producing a short story is different from producing a novel. Could you speak to that?
Sure. I think that, a short story is usually just, for me, is usually just one thematic element, where a novel might encompass a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So a short story is just my novels are tightly focused and every word is important too,
right.
but with a short story, those things become even more crucial because you're only taking a few pages to tell the story. It's sort of one of those indefinable things, though, too. I mean, well, I know when I start out what's going to be a novel and what's going to be a short story, and I don't really think all that much about why that is, but I suppose it has something to do with just the passage of time and the different themes and perhaps the number of characters. Yeah.
And you can develop those characters in a novel where you wouldn't necessarily be able to in a short story, right?
Well, you have to develop them. You have a little more time to develop them in a novel, whereas in a short story you have to use a few defining strokes to create a character, because you don't have chapters or pages and pages to... Oh.
When you're doing a short story, and this is something I've asked just about everybody in this series, is when you do a short story, are you following like the sexual response cycle of, you know, arousal and plateau and orgasm and resolution, or can you start any place along that line, or do you even have to have like a happy ending, so to speak?
Well, I don't always have a happy ending,
and
I don't think people, I don't think readers appreciate that very much, so.
You mean they're expecting? They're expecting.
People want a happy ending.
Everyone gets off and gets all smooth.
But I never thought of it as mirroring sexual arousal and gratification and.
The sexual response cycle.
But that is true. That's true for, I mean. I think fiction in general, you know, you're
there's an arc
building
to the
up
story
slowly.
Line.
Yes, the arc, and there's a climax, and then there's a relief. So yeah,
and everyone takes a nap. There, excellent. Do you have a preference for writing one or the other? Is one easier for you to write?
Well, a short story takes less time, but I actually prefer to write a novel. I kind of like taking that longer journey. It can be like writing several short stories, but I think most of my work is character driven, and so I get to know my characters when I write a book, and I always feel when I finish it kind of a sense of loss when they're gone.
Right. I often get that from reading too. I get like to the last paragraph and I'm like, no, I don't want to finish this.
And I don't write many things that are, you know, that I'm thinking are going to be a series or that there will be sequels. So I'm really kind of sad when they're gone. And I think I wrote a blog about this recently because of a quote from Truman Capote, and I think he said something like, finishing a story is like taking a child out in the backyard and shooting it.
Oh. Leak to Truman.
So maybe that's part of the reason I prefer a novel. I get to spend more time with my characters and experience more, where a short story, you know, I mean, I might begin and end it in the space of a week.
Right. Interesting. That is fascinating. Could I ask you to read again?
Yes.
You promise?
Yes. I'd be happy to.
Excellent. Even if you're not happy, I want you to read.
I'm going to read a little bit from a story called Manamorphosis.
Cute.
And you'll, if you're familiar with Metamorphosis by Kafka, you'll recognize the first line I'm going to read. This was only published as an ebook, but I want to tell everyone listening that this will be part of a collection coming out next summer in a print book called On the Edge.
Okay, so, good. Thank you.
Anyway, this is from Manamorphosis. I awoke one morning from uneasy dreams to find my penis had transformed itself into a vagina. I was lying on my back and, as is my custom, reached down to give myself a good morning grope. It was my perky way of welcoming in the day. Usually, what awaited my wandering hand was a large column of flesh, with the tension of a steel girder and the approximate length and width of professional wrestler The Rock's forearm. My blood ran cold when the hand felt nothing. Imagine how stressed you feel when your wallet or keys have suddenly vanished. Multiply that to the nth degree, and you'll maybe get a hint of the alarm I felt when I discovered my penis had disappeared. Hoping for a different outcome, I reached down again. Yes, the pubic hair was there in all its curly, silky glory. The cock, however, had flown the roost. But as I groped, I discovered that in its place was not nothing, but something new, different, and damp. Although much of my sexual experience had of late been with the male gender, I had in my misspent youth explored the other side of the sexual coin to a ridiculous, self-denying extent, and if you've ever met my son, you know it's true. So I recognized the contours and texture of the feminine apparatus referred to by doctors as a vagina. Everyone else calls it a pussy, box, hair pie, beaver, muff, bush, twat, cunt, quim, red snapper, bearded clam, and God only knows what else. But what was one of those things doing between my legs? How had it managed to get there? Where had what the doctors referred to as a penis gone? You probably call it a dick, cock, wee-wee, prostate poker, Johnson, prick, sausage, rod. Albeit a mustache of sweat had formed on my upper lip, I couldn't restrain myself from beginning to explore my lower lips. They had a silky smoothness, a not unpleasant bumpiness, an unevenness that appealed to my sense of aesthetic asymmetry. As I gently massaged them, I felt them unfold like a small fleshy flower. They sort of puffed up, which made me think how much money people like Melanie Griffith and Barbara Hershey could have saved on collagen if they could have mastered this trick on their upper lips. But I couldn't be distracted by thoughts of movie star snatches when I suddenly found I had my own. As I probed onward, and let me tell you, I haven't felt such a dizzying mix of nausea and pleasure since I was 12 years old, when similar manual exploration of my private parts resulted in watching my purple-helmeted warrior vomit up a copious amount of love juice all over my family's living room burnt orange shag carpeting. I discovered the lips became slippery, as if a phantom tongue were coating them with a semi-gloss coat of saliva. From those same lips, a dizzying pulse radiated outward, infusing my entire being with a tingling heat. This was fun. The feeling was becoming more and more delicious, the dim bedroom disappearing around me as I let one, two, three fingers slip inside, while my thumb, as if it had been born to such maneuvers, found the tiny pleasure button just above the lips, which I pushed and stroked repeatedly, to heavenly results. Christ, I thought, I've got a pussy and I'm coming. Is this a dream? Will I ever want to get out of bed again? How, I wondered, were my sisters of the world able to get out of bed themselves and work, play, and raise children when such a lovely distraction lay right between their legs? I grinned, forgetting for a moment the oddness of my morning metamorphosis, and relaxed into my pillows, feeling sated.
Totally. That's so grand. Holy cow. So I'm going to guess that you actually have a vagina somewhere hidden away.
Well, let's just say I have some familiarity with...
Is that right?
With that part of the anatomy.
I love it.
In my misspent youth.
So,
No, it wasn't misspent.
Of course not. I mean, what could be misspent about... enjoying. So I wanted to ask a question of you that I've been dying to ask other authors, but you are the first author that is seriously writing the horror and suspense genre, in the horror and suspense genre. And the question has something to do with the intimate connection in the human psyche between sexuality and suspense. And the reason that I ask that is that just about every horror story I can think of, even you know the old horror movies that we enjoyed as children, I used to watch Shock Theater in Chicago, and yours was Suspense Theater or something?
Chiller Theater.
Chiller Theater, right. And, you know, it was Frankenstein and, you know, the Mummy and Wolfman and all those old classics. All of those... have at least a veiled reference to sexuality. The monster, the, you know, the Dracula, whatever, has this intimate connection, you know, sometimes with looks and whatnot, you know, toward the young woman, and she's always in her nightgown, mm-hmm. and she's going down a flight of stairs. You know, it's just filled with sexual imagery.
Were you aware of that as a kid when you were watching
I don't think I was consciously thinking about that kind of thing, but I do think that there's a connection between fear and love and sexuality. And I mean, love itself can be a pretty terrifying emotion,
right.
And
right.
losing love or not finding love are terrifying things.
Right.
And I think one of the things I thought was a good parallel is the how the physical responses to fear and sexual arousal are very similar.
Right.
The increased pulse rate, the, you know, the
sweating
hands
and right.
you know, there is a connection there just on a very basic physical level.
Right.
So maybe that's part of the reason that fear and sexuality can get tied together.
Mm-hmm. And we'd like to go there. I mean, as humans, we, you know, as long as it's
fun.
It's a safe journey.
As long as it's safe, yes.
Because, you know, I mean, there's nothing more satisfying than, you know, to be, you know...
Scared.
I
mean,
sitting on the couch.
Someone who likes
exactly.
that sort of thing. Yeah.
Exactly that. And, you know, now that you say this, I think that is a fascinating connection, you know, between the body's response to fear or suspense and to sexual arousal. And I think that's
mm-hmm.
fascinating. But there's also that connection between monsters and sexual awakening and menace and forbidden sexuality. One of the most powerful images that I can recall ever seeing was the seduction scene in The Hunger
mm-hmm.
with Susan Sarandon and
Catherine Deneuve.
She's playing the piano, and you know there's this intimate thing going on, and then they fall into a sexual embrace and wind up in bed, but it's also vampire. So the connection between this evil thing or undead thing or this whatever thing and this forbidden sexuality
mm-hmm.
Was very clear there. But even in the old movies, you know, the Dracula, he makes his conquests vampire conquests, his submissives.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all that play as well, the BDSM kind of thing.
Well, it's like women being attracted to the bad boy,
right.
or maybe men being attracted to the bad girl. I
right.
think we danger excites us,
yeah.
and I
right.
think that's probably
yeah.
where that's coming from.
Yeah. And, you know, and the moral of the stories always were, look out, beware, don't do this, don't go down the stairs in your nightgown
mm-hmm.
with just a candle, because that's really dumb. I used to scream at the television as
oh,
a kid.
Yeah,
going,
everybody
no,
does that.
Don't do that. Beware, because if you allow yourself, if you are not vigilant, if you are not pure, if you are not wholesome, that somehow you will be consumed
mm-hmm.
by this evil, and you know, and it will certainly wind up in sexual excess and sexual deviancy and whatnot. Very interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that a good portion of that is at play in your work as well. I mean, you were talking last week about how this twisted obsession, sexual obsession, in some of your characters morphs into a killing spree.
Yeah, like I was thinking of my serial killer in I Am, who preys on gay men through internet hookup sites,
mm-hmm.
because it's sort of the perfect crime. He
right.
can engage in instant messages with people
and charm,
and then they get, and this happens every day. It's happening right
exactly.
now. People are inviting strangers over into their homes without knowing anything about
right.
them. And I thought that led me to, well, what if this stranger
right.
was a killer? And
yeah.
and I think the killer was a man who did not accept himself as a gay man, and
mm-hmm.
and he was probably, in a way, killing that part
right.
of himself
right,
over
right.
and over again
right.
when he went to these guys' homes that invited him in and killed them.
Right. Besides, I mean, you know, in the anonymity of cyberspace, you can be charming and stuff like that and really cloak oneself until...
Oh, yeah, he would adopt whatever persona he thought would appeal to his victim.
Interesting. Gosh. Now I want to ask you a question about something that I've discovered some months ago when I was talking with James Lear, and that gay fiction of every stripe has a sizable female following. I am assuming that you are aware of that yourself?
I am aware of that, and I sort of, you know, when I first published my first two books in the early 90s, I was really a horror writer. I wasn't a gay horror writer. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really looking to, there was eroticism in the books, but I wasn't looking to bring those things to the fore. And then when I published I Am in 2007, I thought, this is a book that's will be read mainly by gay men. And then I started writing more and more, and, you know, I've published a lot more since then. And it came as a surprise to me. I can remember when I found out that your books aren't... I mean, yes, there are gay men reading your books, but probably for every one of them, there's several women who are reading the books, and they're straight women.
Mm-hmm.
And then it led me to discover that, you know, a really sizable part of the audience for gay male, especially romance and erotica, is not men, but it's women and straight women.
Mm. Interesting.
And a lot of it's written by straight women.
Yes, yes, that's amazing. Would you say that since you've learned this, that your writing has altered in any way? That now that you know you have a sizable female audience, do you write to that audience? Last week you said you write for yourself, but...
Yeah, and that's what I was just thinking, that I don't think I alter. I think the only thing is I sort of understand what they want as an audience, and I think in
like
general...
Like more vaginas, things like you just read.
They want... they want more sex, they want more romance, and I think those things have... I'm incorporating them more and more into my writing and getting away a bit from the suspense and horror, although those are elements, but I'm bringing the romantic and erotic parts of things more to the forefront. Because the women that read that stuff actually really buy a lot of books.
Right.
You know, they're the kind of people that buy 4 and 5 books a week and read them. So yeah, there's a little... There's part of me that wants to please those people.
Find out what they like and how they like it and give it to them.
But on the other hand, it is, I'm still writing for myself and I, you know, I have to be entertained by what I'm doing and believe in what I'm doing. So I don't want to just become a hack that's churning up what I think the market wants, because I don't think that works.
Speaking of which, could I ask you to read again?
Speaking of hacks, did you read something?
Hey, you. you know, I don't want you to get away without our money's worth, damn it.
Okay. I wish we had more time, because I actually have more to read than we have time for. So I'm just going to read...
Well, let me ask you one question before you do that, then. Have you ever thought of, you know, reading your work and putting your stuff up on your site as podcasts? You have such a talent. I mean, your reading is brilliant. I mean,
I
as opposed
like to
a lot of
when I was
people.
In Chicago, I used to read in public a lot, but I haven't really done much of like recording myself reading. So
maybe we can work together and make some of that happen, because I, you know, this stuff is great. I mean, there are some people that I've interviewed, you know, who write brilliantly but don't read their stuff very well. You do both.
Yeah, thank you.
So yes, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, this is from
And the background noises are provided by Ginger the dog.
She's anticipating this next excerpt, which is from Fugue, which is a BDSM book. And as you can hear, Ginger is into that. Okay, you gotta be quiet now.
Okay, Gene.
Girl. Okay, this is from a novella that was published as an ebook called Fugue, and it will also be included in the collection On the Edge that comes out this summer. It's the kind of damp and filthy basement you read about in novels written by the Marquis de Sade, or authors who sign their books with only the initial O. It's the type of cellar you discover in a true crime book by Anne Rule or Greg Olson, a shocking chiller about twisted men who keep their victims shackled, naked, and desperate for long periods of time. Men who enjoy seeing their victims suffer, who enjoy playing long, drawn-out, and elaborate versions of cat and mouse. There's the whiff of decay and mildew in the air. You just know that beetles, roaches, and other creatures that scurry from the light make their homes here, hiding within chinks, between bricks and black areas where the walls don't quite meet the floor. Somewhere, water drips endlessly. The only light is from a dim-wadded bulb that hangs in the middle of this space, unadorned with even so much as a shade, and which is turned off and on by a rusting, beaded cord. It hums. Some grayish natural light might, say, seep in during the day through high horizontal windows besotted with grime and covered with yellowing newspapers taped over their glass. The darkness skitters into corners, hiding in shadows where the walls disappear. Here the cinder blocks are broken up by rough and dripping mortar. The floor is concrete, stained, cold. The feel of grime is palpable, gritty beneath my bare toes. These are my surroundings. Pipes run the length of the ceiling. It is to these pipes that I am chained, my arms raised above my head to accommodate leather cuffs and the links of steel that marry me to the pipes. For now it is painless, but I am a seer of pain and know what the future holds. How the muscles in my arms will first ache, then scream for relief, and finally succumb to the numbness that I will curse. It is as if the muscles and tendons in my arms have a kind of sense memory. They know what's coming, and their presence fills me with a sense of delicious dread. You may wonder how one can both anticipate and dread pain at the same time. I do not. Some things about the dichotomy between pleasure and pain are not mysterious to me, although they might be difficult for me to put into words that you'd understand. To stoop to a cliché, it's just something you have to know on an instinctive level. It's a slave thing. Shackles embrace my ankles, keeping me anchored to the cool, damp floor. This sense of immobility ratchets up the tension and anticipation, and these feelings war within me, causing tingles throughout my body in much the same way as the restraints holding me in place do. I ache for something to happen, yet know I am powerless to bring anything about. Patience is a virtue I have learned, honed in its tutelage now for several years. Ever since I met my master, that man of mine, the one I love, the seer and deliverer of pain, of pleasure, of love, and discipline.
Ooh. Love it. Love
Thank
it.
You.
So, I mean, you didn't even mention cock in that. You didn't mention any genitals. You didn't mention sexual acts. And yet that is just insanely erotic.
That whole book is all sex.
Hmm.
But I'm proud of it because it's not pornography.
Yes.
I don't think it's pornography. Yes. I think it's about sex.
Yes.
And it's about a sexual relationship.
Yes.
And the balance of power.
Yes.
And but the whole 57 pages are is all sex.
Wow. That's amazing. Good for you. Gosh. May I ask what you look for in the work of other erotic artists, either written or visual?
Gee, that's a tough question.
Do you consume? I mean, do you read a lot of erotica or look at naughty pictures? Do you like Muscle Magazine?
You know, I have consumed movies. A lot of that kind of thing, mm-hmm. and to be quite honest, I'm kind of jaded uh-huh. toward. So, for something to actually arouse me would have to be pretty mm-hmm. pretty good. Mm-hmm. I think what I would need is in something written is there would have to be a strong connection with the people in the right. story, not necessarily about what goes in where and how right. fast it right. moves and mm-hmm. that kind of thing, but the people. Mm-hmm. I said this last week. It's true. It's more about what's in your head than between your legs.
Right.
So I think I find the situation and the characters mm-hmm. more. That's what I would look for.
Well, it's obvious in what you just read for us. I mean that's. I mean, if that's what interests you and you're writing it down, it probably would be relatively the same thing that you were looking for in the work of others.
Yes. And what turns me right. off is like just long descriptions of sexual mm-hmm. acts
right.
and just a weak story or right, weak characters right, built yeah. around that.
Right.
That's a turn off. So yeah. I can tell you that's what yeah. I don't look for.
Yeah. yeah. And there's a lot of that out
there's
there.
There's a lot of that, it? And there are people that do look for that. But yeah. to me, I find it either silly or boring.
Mm-hmm. I do too. I mean, after you figure out what goes where and how it goes there, and you know, I mean, and the permutations are limited. So
yeah,
and then after a while, the vocabulary becomes really. You know, I mean, you have to go way out of your way to, you know, use words that you haven't used a million times before to describe body parts. And, you know, after a while, that just gets nutty to my mind. Anyhow, who are your inspirations and who are your sexual heroes, if you have any?
Probably the writers that have had the most influence on me are what I usually tell people are Patricia Highsmith, mm-hmm. who's wonderfully weird, and James Purdy, who has written a lot of, who's probably, I think, one of the best 20th century American writers, and really underrated, and a lot of his novels do have homoerotic themes. Ruth Rendell, who's a British mystery writer, and who writes as Barbara Vine, and she writes psychological suspense, I think is a big influence on how I look at building suspense and, mm-hmm. and mysteries and mm-hmm. books. And Flannery O'Connor, just because of her wonderfully weird worldview and her characters that you just mm-hmm. can't imagine.
Mm-hmm.
coming from anywhere else but her.
Interesting. Sexual heroes?
You know, I kind of coming up blank on that one. Can we make it multiple choice?
Well, I try not to put words in people's minds in this regard anyhow, because that might mean something different to one person, or it might mean something to one person and different to another. I, in terms of sexual heroes, what I had in mind when I first wrote that as a question is there are some very pivotal people in the world of human sexuality that made a huge difference in my life. Alfred Kinsey was one.
Mm-hmm.
Wardell Pomeroy was another. He directed my doctoral thesis. Annie Sprinkle.
Oh yeah,
Betty Friedan.
I just thought of a woman I met when I lived in Chicago, who I would say is kind of a sexual hero. Have you heard of Cynthia Plastercaster?
No.
Oh, you have to look her up. She's,
okay.
She's been around probably since the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
and she's made plaster casts of rock star penises. She
oh,
started
no
out
kidding.
As a groupie. She's done like museum shows in New
no
York,
kidding.
And I actually got the opportunity to meet her and perform with her in a kind of erotica show in Chicago. And she's just as a lot of people I've met that are involved in this sort of thing. She was just the sweetest person.
No kidding.
So yeah, I would say Cynthia Plastercaster. I guess I admire people as sexual heroes who are kind of can be true to themselves and can unapologetically follow what they want.
I think that too. I mean, that's you know, and people who are on the cutting edge, and you know, people who are making a difference, and you know, standing against the popular culture's notions of sexuality, and you know, standing against assimilation and rather advocating for integration. I see that in, like in the gay community with the, nowadays, it's all about you know, in white picket fences and wedding rings and you know, the house in the country and being just like.
And let's
our
not
heterosexual
talk about
peers.
The,
yeah.
What I read from Feud.
Yes, exactly. Exactly that. And it comes at such a huge, enormous price. And that means assimilation to me, as opposed to integration, where I can bring, you know, all my uniqueness and all my, you know, who I am and my sexuality, and I can enrich the popular culture with it. So, but anyhow, one final question. What does the future hold for you and your work?
Well, specifically, I have two books coming out next month. One is the Tales from the Sexual Underground, which I read a piece from last week, which is a collection of short stories and essays and nonfiction all about sexual underground, prostitutes, pimps, porn stars, and then I have a novel, which is a gay werewolf novel called The Blue Moon Cafe, which is exciting for me because for many years I could not get out of the rut of writing. Not it's not a rut, but Chicago was so familiar to me and so inspirational to me. But Blue Moon Cafe is set here in Seattle, and a lot of...
Is that your first Seattle-based
thing? There was an e-book called Superstar that... was set here. That was the first thing I actually wrote that was set here. It opens with a young man about to commit suicide by jumping off the Aurora Bridge.
Interesting. Cool.
But, so those are coming out in March, and I'm working on a gay haunted house story called A Demon Inside, which I just signed a contract for. So
is that here in town too? Located?
No, actually, it's in Wisconsin.
And no kidding. Oh, interesting. Very well, yes. Cool. Nutty dog. Alrighty. Well, we're over time again, and I could go on and on, as you well know, because I have way more questions to ask.
Yeah, there were some other
really good ones too, I might add. But for the time being, this will have to do, and so I'm going to ask you to give us your website address and walk us around a bit. Tell us where we can buy your work.
Well, my website is www.rickrreed.com. That's sort of the portal toward everything else. I also have a blog, which is... actually, I can't remember the URL for it.
But it's linked. From
but
the,
it's... Yeah.
Right, got it.
And
we'll have this all on all the posting on Dr. Dick.
And since most of my stuff lately has been published by small presses, it's really much easier to find online than it is in bookstores, but most of it should, even if you can't find it in a bookstore and you're one of these people that doesn't like to shop online, any bookstore should be able to order something.
Right, exactly.
So,
good, good, good. So I want to thank you on behalf of all of our audience for being so generous with your precious time, both last week and this. We are certainly the richer for the experience, and maybe we will have opportunities to talk together again in the future.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Well, thank you again.
Having me.
That's wonderful having you. So until we meet again then, we'll be seeing you in cyberspace. Bye.
Bye.
Fantastic show, huh? Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Remember, we are soon to leave for our annual spring break. The next Monday podcast will appear in 2 weeks on April 12th, and we will be returning to our traditional Q&A format at that time, so don't miss it.
How did you do that?
Well, it's easy, because I'm the boss. I just said we're going to have a spring break, and so we will have a spring break. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is the fabulous Fleshlight and Fleshjack. Say, guys, have you been looking for the perfect gift for yourself, a gift that will give you hours of fun and pleasure and never run out of batteries? Well, I have just the thing for you. Once you've tried a Fleshlight, you'll never settle for second best. You know, all you guys out there who keep complaining to me about your short fuse, well, I have a tip for you. Being a great lover, being able to control your orgasmic response and last for as long as you'd like takes practice. Sure, you can learn to last longer simply by using your hand, but now there's an even more effective way to train yourself for sexual stamina and endurance with a partner. Allow me to introduce you to the Endurance Jack. It's just one of the fine designs from Fleshlight. It comes with the stamina insert, which has extra large bumps and a tight canal. With just a little practice with this puppy, you'll be able to last longer, gain control of your ejaculatory response, and avoid untimely climax. Once you've accomplished this with an Endurance Jack, you'll have all the skills you need to last and last with a partner. And remember, these fine products are made in the good old U.S. of A. Look for the Fleshjack banner right there on the sidebar of DrDickSexAdvice.com.
I admire you. I really do. I admire you.
Thanks, I guess. And look for all of Dr. Dick's podcasts on iTunes. You'll find me in the podcast section under Health, subcategory Sexuality. Or just search for Dr. Dick's Sex Advice. Don't forget to subscribe and feel free to leave a comment when you do. Until next week, remember, sex is good. And good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.